My name is Pat Hayden, and this is a session on the history of women in Lutheran higher education. The reason that we're doing this tonight is because it's National Women's History Week, and it's a good opportunity for me to try to share with all of you what I have been working on for the last year, and especially the last 2 months up here at Holden, trying to type a very long paper. And it's, let's see, the last page in the typewriter was page 89. And you can be relieved that I'm not going to read that to you. instead, what I will try to do is share some examples from the paper, some of my conclusions and assumptions about the paper. And I hope that I can talk for about 30 minutes and then leave some time for us to discuss and for you to ask questions if there's anything that you'd like to ask questions about. I'm particularly interested if you've had experience with co-education, going to a school where both men and women studied, would share some of your perceptions of that with me, whether it was a Lutheran school or not. It would be useful information. Let me begin by saying why I'm doing this, or how I got started doing this. This is a paper that I'm writing for a friend of mine named Richard Solberg, who is writing a book. He is writing a book on the history of Lutheran higher education in the United States, and he was asked to write that book by all of the Lutheran colleges in the United States. The colleges of the American Lutheran Church, the Lutheran Church in America, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, they all come together in an organization called LECNA, Lutheran Educators Conference of North America. And LECNA asked Dick if he would write this book. To our knowledge, it's the first attempt to do a denominational history of their educational efforts in the United States, which is a little astonishing since churches were the main source of schools, being originators of schools in the United States for the last 200 years. Dick has an enormous task ahead of him because Lutheran education, higher education, this should define meaning colleges and universities. It started in the United States in 1832, which is about 152 years ago now, and there have been over 150 institutions of higher learning started by Lutherans in the United States during that time. There are 40 of them around today. Some of them have merged with each other. A lot of them have gone out of business, as you can see from that number. Many, many times more schools were started by Lutherans than that. And part of what Dick and I are trying to do is to figure out what all the schools were that went into making up those 40 colleges that are still around today, and why it is they survived when so many of the others did not. Since he has a big task, he asked a couple of people to help him. There's somebody who's writing about the history of athletics in Lutheran higher education. That might be more interesting than the history of women. And he asked me to...
You don't believe it.
No, I don't believe it. I don't believe it. And he asked me to do the history of women. It may sound like a very strange way to start, but I'd like to start by telling you sort of the framework within which I've tried to do this paper. First of all, most history papers are written by going to the source of what happened. It's called primary sources, going to letters that people have written, to diaries, having interviews with the people themselves, looking at the minutes of meetings, reading newspapers, trying to get as close to the event that happened as you possibly can. That's what the task of the historian is. My work has been 90% with secondary sources, which means reports written by people from the original sources. So already there's at least one filter through which I'm trying to do my studies. And these secondary sources are by and large institutional histories of the colleges that have been done. They usually are written when the college reaches 50 years of age, sometimes 75 years of age, and sometimes 100. And if you need good bedtime reading guaranteed to induce insomnia, pick up a history of a college. It's just deadly. Some of them are very well written, and that's a delight to find. Luther College is one of the best ones, written by David Nelson, who was an English professor with a wry sense of humor and a real ability to get in and rattle the skeletons in the Luther College closet. And so it's more interesting than most of them, but most of them are pretty bad. So I start with having to use those kinds of institutional histories. I should say that they have all been written by men, and that they have focused almost completely on what I call the institutional aspects of history. Who the presidents were, who were elected to the boards of trustees, what decisions the board made, what kinds of financial problems they had, how they related to the churches, the buildings that they built when, how they raised the money for them, etc. And what I call life experiences, what actually happened to all the people going to school at these places, there's very little of that in the institutional histories, except for an occasional anecdote which gives some kind of color to this otherwise very practical and mechanical sort of picture. As you can imagine, to try to find out what happened to women in institutional histories is a real bit of detective work, because the only women that emerge through institutional histories are those who are exceptional in some way. They're the first woman who graduated, the first faculty woman, a woman who was enough outstanding alumna that they were given some kind of a distinguished award, a woman who gave a large donation of money to the school, the women's auxiliary who furnished the dorm. I mean, you know, you can put the references to women in most institutional histories on 2 5x7 note cards. That means it's a little hard to get a picture of who those women were who studied at Lutheran schools, who taught at Lutheran schools, who served Lutheran schools. You get a glimpse, but it's pretty distorted, and their role and influence is really left a lot to the imagination. I just would say that in trying to do this paper, I discovered that there are a very few schools, first of all, which are concerned about their histories, and secondly, concerned about the histories of women in relationship to that school. St. Olaf and Luther are the only two I found where individual women faculty members have begun to go into the archives and tried to dig out some of the experiences that women had at the schools. I hope that one of the outcomes of my paper might be to suggest some areas that could be explored by women who are interested in studying history at a school. But it's at the very beginning of that discipline rather than a well-developed field. If anybody has a desire to do a master's or a PhD in history, I can give you 3 or 4 good dissertation topics. Let me say that what my task has been, then, in the midst of those kinds of restrictions, is to take all of those little references to women, to compile them like this, and to compare them to each other, and to see that what happened in one school was either similar or dissimilar to what happened in another school, and thereby to kind of uncover a pattern. I think it's important to do this for 2 reasons, and they have to do with the larger realm of women's history in general. First of all, is to see that the history of women is not an individual history, but is a corporate history. We've been taught as women to regard things that happen to us as happening to us as individuals. And we very seldom make connections between what happens to us as an individual and what happens to the next woman as an individual. But when you start putting those individual experiences together, you begin to see some patterns. And when you see those patterns, you can see how women can act together to create a different kind of future. And the second thing that's maybe more important is to see how valuable women's participation and contributions were. Just look at the newspaper. How many times when you read a newspaper is there a story about women and what they do in their ordinary course of life? Are there many stories? Very few stories. What is regarded as real historically is what I call the institutional history. That's regarded as things that make a difference. And the things that women traditionally do, caring for home, caring for children, being concerned about relationships, these things are not considered the stuff of history. Except that that's beginning to change now. And we're seeing that what women do really is valuable and really is of equal worth to the institutional things. And I hope that my paper will say something about that, that what women have done is comparable to what men have done. Not more important, but comparable in importance. And that, I think, is a real key. That's the main thesis of my paper, which I'm trying to explore, is that how women were involved in Lutheran higher education was essential to the success of the colleges, was every bit as important as the preachers who rode the circuits to try to raise money for the colleges, for those people who came and led the institutions as presidents or as faculty members. That without women's participation in a lot of very hidden ways, these colleges would not have been able to survive. That's all kind of background, and I want to just say kind of one other thing about background before I get into this. And that is, I had a choice when I started to write this history, as anybody does when they start to write anything, especially if you're writing as a part of what's called oppressed. There are three different kinds of history you can write, and they appeal to three different audiences. I'm going to pick up an analogy from politics of Jesus here, if I can. The first one is that you can write zealot history. You can write revolutionary history. You can go in and look for those examples of the shocking mistreatment of women. And you can catalog these and use them as a spur to action, as a way of criticizing and blaming those who were unenlightened, the sexists who ran the institutions, the holders of power. That's one way to write history. And that history appeals then to zealots, to people who are wanting to change things. Okay? The second way you can write history is what is called compensatory history. And I call this the Sadducee option. This is the reformist way of writing history. This is a way of saying, I will lift up and show you the examples of women's contributions in order that we can have a better understanding of the present situation and to provide role models for modern women. We will lift up and highlight those examples of the few outstanding women who have attempted to reform the institution, who made a difference where they were, and all the rest of us can imitate them, right? That's what's called compensatory history. A third way, which has been identified but which hasn't been named. I gave it a name, and I won't dare try to relate this to politics of Jesus. But I call it comparable history. And it's history that sees the significance of women in the Western world as every bit as important as the significance of men. it requires that we expand the categories of history and the behaviors that are accepted as historical, and that it's a way of trying to understand all of what happened and why it happened, including both men and women, rather than making men central and women peripheral, so that it's history that we can all claim. I don't know. Spence, is there any kind of name for that from Politics of Jesus?
No, it's called the fifth option.
It's called the fifth option. Okay. We'll call this fifth option history. Okay. Because there are now 40 colleges in the United States, Dick and I sat down and picked 9 of them that I would try to look at, because there was no way that I could look at all 40. So these are the ones that I'm going to look at briefly tonight. And let me sort of show you where they are. Some of you will know where some of them are, some not. Luther College in Decorah, Iowa.
Luther College.
Doesn't sound familiar to me.
There are two alumni in this room.
Jesse, this next one may sound familiar to you. St. Olaf College in Northfield, Missouri. St. Olaf is a little bit south of the Twin Cities there.
Isn't that the college that's founded on a bluff and run on the same principle?
You see, we have representatives here. A variety. Augustana, Rock Island, Illinois, which is
south.
Here's Moline, Rock Island. It's right on the Mississippi River at the border of Illinois and Iowa. Concordia River Forest, which is also in Illinois over here by Chicago, or Seward, Nebraska, except I couldn't find any information about that one, so I decided to leave it out. It's a school of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and they don't have a good reputation for women's diversity. Muhlenberg is a school over here in Muhlenberg. Named for one of the earliest preachers who came to the United States from Germany. He is over here in Allentown, Pennsylvania. And Wittenberg University is in Springfield, Ohio, right here, sort of in the middle of Ohio. Roanoke College, down here in somewhere in Virginia, right there, Salem, Virginia, back in the Blue Ridge Mountains, and a little school called Marion College, which was in Marion, Virginia, that was an all-women school that existed for 94 years and then went out of business. Pacific Lutheran, over here in Tacoma, is another school here. And then another women's college also down here in Virginia called Elizabeth, which lasted for about 10 years, died in a fire. Born in a fight and died in a fire was the epitaph for Elizabeth College. And Grace College, which was a dream in the eye of a woman of the United Lutheran Church in America for Washington, D.C., for which there is an exquisite prospectus that I can show you, but the college never happened.
You have all on that side of the world, and only one over here.
Well, that's because there are only two Lutheran colleges on this side.
What's the matter with Lutherans over here?
There's one up in Tacoma, and there's another one down here in Thousand Oaks, and otherwise all the Lutheran schools are in the Midwest.
Okay.
And there's one in Texas. Yes, Texas Lutheran College. Okay. So, what did I find out? What would you guess that I found out? What would you say I found? Give me some ideas. Thank you. In reference to women in Lutheran higher education.
You have 9 pages. Is that what you said?
9 pages?
89
pages.
89.
And I've just made it into the 20th century. So that all has to do with the 1800s.
I guess we had a hard time to find anything about women.
That's true. I had a hard time to find anything.
Few women in the very beginning.
Few, what, Jenna?
One or two that stand out right in the very beginning.
Right. One or two that stand out right in the very beginning, but otherwise very few women.
Probably not very many in 1940.
So did you make up history?
No. That's fun, but that's called fiction rather than history.
Pat, did you find differences in attitudes towards education for women in this country versus the European countries where the Lutheran immigrants came from?
Yes, very, very great differences. That was one of the first really nice surprises. Education for women in Europe and in Scandinavia was considered okay for women who were upper class. They studied usually with a private tutor or went to women's sections of universities and studied language and literature, but they were otherwise not expected to, and that they were expected to use their learning to be wives and mothers, but they were not expected to use their learning in any other way. And that was the attitude that was really brought to the United States when the Lutheran immigrants came. They came from Germany with the three Ks, what? Kirche, Kusche, and Kinder? My German's pretty bad, but it means kitchen, church, and children, the three Ks. These were women's domains. The same thing happened with the women from Scandinavia. What changed in the United States was this new frontier setting where there was too much to do and not enough people. So women were able to become employed and to get involved actively making settlements and towns and schools and churches in a way that they would never have been able to do in the old country. So that is one thing I found. I found an interesting attitude, which is that women are equal to men, but they have been conditioned by society to be inferior. So that if you give men and women the same education, then you will make them equal. Churches were the ones to make this attitude most common, and it's the reason why churches began schools for women where they did, and they began schools for men and women together, co-ed schools. What we don't find is too much of a comparable attitude, which is that if men and women are equal, if they get equal education, they're also equal if they get roles. I mean, they're also equal in the roles they can assume. This one was very much slower to come along and didn't really happen until this century. Just some brief information about the schools. The first schools that were started by Lutherans were started two in Ohio within 2 years of each, or within 15 years of each other. One in St. Louis, Missouri, and one in Pennsylvania. And they were started by church people to train preachers. Because the first two things that immigrants needed when they came were preachers for their congregations and teachers for their schools.
What years were those around?
The first school was Gettysburg in 1832, or actually Capital University in Columbus, Ohio, 1830. And Gettysburg in 1832, and Wittenberg in 1845. All three of them started by German Lutherans, but of different ecclesiastical bends.
What were the differences?
One was high church, one was low church, and one was middle church. High church were people who wanted things just like they were in the old country. Services in German, clerical, people wearing stoles, doing liturgies in the same way they'd been done. Low church were popular churches. They evangelists and preachers and lay people, and get rid of clergy, or at least play down their importance.
Which one was that?
That was more Wittenberg. Then there was the American church, which was, actually that wasn't Wittenberg. That was more Missionary Institute, which started a few years later, 1858. the American church were people who came over and they wanted to become Americans as quickly as possible. They wanted to learn to speak English. They wanted to get the work skills that would enable them to work here quickly. They wanted to have become part of their communities. And Wittenberg University was started to train preachers for those kinds of congregations so that they preached in English as well as in German. There is many different kinds of Lutherans in the 19th century in this country as there were schools. One of the most confusing things is to read about these little groups of clergy who got together and formed their own synod, and then they would have a disagreement with this group of clergy, and so they split, and each little group of clergy started their own school, and that was part of the reason that there were so many schools. They also wanted to train teachers for parochial schools, because public education for elementary levels was a very early thing in the United States, but there was no religion taught in public schools. And the immigrants were very concerned that their children should know the culture and the language and the religion of their home. So they started in settlements where they landed in Pennsylvania and Ohio and Iowa and Wisconsin and North and South Dakota and Minnesota, parallel schools. There'd be a public school and a parochial school. And the parochial school would teach all of these things which the families wanted their kids to learn. That was the first entree for women in the United States, was being teachers at parochial schools for elementary age kids and also for public schools. It wasn't, well, let me just say something else. The churches started schools for preachers and teachers who were all men in the first 40 years that they were doing this, from the 1830s until after the Civil War, in about 1865 or 1870. And then these individual preachers that had been trained whenever they landed in their parish would start their own school. You didn't need a license or permission from anybody. You just simply opened your doors and started teaching. So girls and boys would come to parishes and study with the preacher, and they would learn such exciting things as Latin and Greek and geometry and algebra.
We have an ex-Latin teacher here. The summit is exciting.
Yes, the summit is exciting. And when the pastor moved on to another parish or got tired of teaching, he simply closed the school.
Yeah.
So one of the things that it's been fun to find out is that there are, have been about 70 schools started for women or as coeducational schools between 1840 and 1900 by these pastors. And the average length of life for them was about 9 years. The congregation would start a school, and then they'd get tired of running it, and so it would close. An individual would take it over, and they'd run it for a few years, and then they'd get tired, so they'd sell it to somebody else. So the schools were literally privately owned, and that was the way women were able to study. Until 1874. 1874 is the first time the Lutherans opened a college for which included women, and that was St. Olaf. Does have the
wow.
Da, 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 da. It was a unique college among Lutheran colleges because it said in its opening that it was going to train women to take their full place in American society. And it was also a school to train lay people so that they would be as educated as their clergy to help influence public opinion and responsible citizens. It's the only school that was started that early with that attitude. Other schools didn't begin with those assumptions until almost 1900, which is just 80 years ago. I mean, part of what really surprised me is how recent a lot of this stuff is. The same year that St. Olaf opened, Wittenberg went coeducational. And they went coeducational for the reason that every male school that's ever been all male has gone coeducational.
Get cheerleaders.
Hey, this! They got it. Karen has the magic word, money. They needed money.
It's amazing that you find out what we can do when there's no other option.
Money was the biggest.
No. I mean, that's the men. World War II is the same thing. In the country when there were any men around.
That's right. Women were admitted to schools when schools ran out of money or when there were no male students. Those two reasons only. And the reasons for keeping them out ranged all the way from we need to build a new gymnasium, and that's more important than admitting women to school, to our purpose is to train preachers, and so we're not going to admit women to schools because obviously they don't have anything to do with that purpose. Okay? Wittenberg went co-ed in 1874, but not very many women came to school because there wasn't anything very exciting for them to study at Wittenberg. It was a pre-theological, very classical curriculum until Professor Hezekiah Geiger, who taught mathematics and engineering, secured the adoption of a scientific course, which was a brand new thing in the 1870s, in which a student could substitute 2 years of German, a year of quantitative analysis, and a year of engineering for Greek. With this change in curriculum and a little help from the home front, Professor Geiger's three daughters were the first three women to graduate from Wittenberg University in 1879, 1880, and 1881, respectively. They were the first three women to graduate from colleges in the United States.
Were they a four-year college?
Yes, they were a four-year college. You can imagine, I mean, this. Consider in the 1950s, which was what? 80 years later?
1950s?
Uh-huh. Consider in the 1950s a woman taking an engineering course in order to be able to graduate from college. Mm-hmm. Many women were taking engineering courses in 1950.
So, did you say it was in the 1950s that Wittenberg first admitted?
No, it was 1874.
Oh, okay.
Was when Wittenberg first admitted. Okay. How about that? Just a word about going to school in the 1800s, both if you were men or women, and a little bit about St. Olaf. Life was very rigorous. At one of the schools, you got up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and your schedule went in very program fashioned until 8:30 at night. And then your lights were turned off, and you had bed checks, and your life was very, very completely regimented by people. These rules were suggested for women who were studying. They are not to remain before their looking glasses 1 second longer than is absolutely required by the exigencies of the case.
What's the exigencies?
Some of us need more help than others. They were to read no books whatever, not prescribed by their able and learned preceptors. Not even after they have retired to bed by candlelight. And they were to put love affairs far away from the mind until the school days were ended. As a final word, they were reminded that it is not Lindley Murray's grammar, or that it is Lindley Murray's grammar they are to be in love with, and not Lindley Murray himself. That it is Pike's arithmetic upon which their thoughts are to be centered, and not upon Pike. Yes, actually they did. There is the story at St. Olaf that you had to get permission from the president of the college to be a couple and to go to an event in Northfield, whether it was a concert or a lecture. And the rules were... Really, I'm not kidding. The rules were that you went to the event and you came right straight home. And you were to be home as soon as the event was open. And one night, two couples were seen in a restaurant, if there was such a thing, in downtown Northfield between 9:30 and 10:30 at night.
Defeated Jesse James.
And they were summoned home, and the boys were called into the office. One was suspended from school for a month, and the other one was expelled. And the reason given was that they should have known they were compromising the young women. It was very, very strict.
What happened to the women?
Nothing, as far as I can tell. Because the men were seen as responsible.
The women's students there also.
Yeah. St. Olaf was the first coeducational school, as I said. And it's kind of funny to read the stories of those early days, because the very first building that was built at St. Olaf was the main building with
still
it's where the president lived, and it's where the boys lived, and where the dining hall was, and where the classrooms were. When St. Olaf first got started, before they moved up to the bluff, they studied in some schools, some old public school buildings down in downtown Northfield. These public school buildings were moved up to the hill and set in the middle of the woods behind the main building. And this was called Ladies Hall. And this was where all the ladies lived. When it snowed, they couldn't get to school until somebody came to shovel them out. They had to go outside to get wood from the wood pile and bring it in, because each girl had in her room a stove, a wood stove, that she was responsible for stoking and keeping going. And there was no kindling, so they used to soak the wood in kerosene.
Oh,
you can imagine. They had no indoor plumbing in ladies' halls, so you had to go downstairs outside to the cistern, both to get to wash your hands and to go through the woods to the powder room. And you did this without benefit of any flashlights or other modern devices, torches.
So they used to live that way.
Well, yeah, I guess they were, but it does sound like it was a little rugged.
Pat, when was the first coeducational institution, you know, just public one?
Public one? The first one was in Oberlin, was Oberlin College in Oberlin, Ohio, and it started in 1831.
And this was 1847?
This one was 1874. So the Lutherans have generally been anywhere from 30 to 40 years behind basic American trends in higher education. And that's not surprising, because church institutions are usually pretty conservative. And so they, after things are firmly in place, then they will pick up.
How do Lutherans compare with other religious denominations, you know?
Well, the Methodists were ordaining women in the 1800s.
Yeah. And I know the Presbyterians had colleges for women long before the Lutherans did.
Was Oberlin a denominational in early times?
I think it was when it was open. Most of them were at the early times. There were only a few non-denominational schools in the 18th and 19th centuries. What really broke things open for women was after the Civil War, the passage of the Land Grant Act, the Morrill Act, which established land-grant colleges in all the western states. These were co-ed from the very beginning, and they made it possible for women to study very practical subjects, which allowed them to be teachers and a variety of other things, mostly in what we would call the domestic and fine arts. And the way that women first got really into Lutheran schools was when they started music conservatories. Then the women came to study. And so whenever you see graduates of a school, they're in music, in art, or in language. And when women were finally admitted to faculties, that's what they taught, music, art, or language. even still today, it's rare that you find women professors in the sciences. Occasionally you find them in history. But it's still in music, language, and art that you find them, and nursing, which got started around the time of the Second World War as a profession for women.
Second World War?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were no nurses' colleges really before that were in Lutheran schools. They were related to hospitals.
What, I know one where the nursing school was in a mental hospital. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting.
Just a little bit about the story of Luther College, because I told Dave I'd talk about this. There were a couple of real holdouts in the Lutheran Church against women. Actually, there were four of them. But
that's my school.
Luther College was started as the premier school for Norwegian preachers in 1861. And it steadfastly resisted coeducation for 50 years. Every time it was brought up, the president was violently opposed to it. And what he did was to get a few of his friends to go off someplace else in Minnesota or North Dakota and start a school for women. So that they would deflect the energy to make Luther co-education. And this tactic succeeded until the Depression came in the 1930s.
And they needed the money.
And they needed money. But the big fight at Luther in the 1930s was whether women would bring in more money than they would spend. Because one of the arguments that was used for keeping women out was it'll cost too much money to add the facilities, to make arrangements for things to be co-education. Oh, I should say about St. Olaf, they didn't get indoor plumbing in the ladies' hall for 30 years after St. Olaf started, from 1874. Well, actually, even more than that, it was 1912 before they really got a proper dormitory at St. Olaf.
It was the same for men, though, also?
No, actually men had better privileges. They got a new dorm sooner than women did, and they also had access to baths, which women did. Big, huge tin tubs, and you had a ticket machine, and you could buy a bath for 5 cents. Men could do this, but women couldn't.
10 cents for clean water, 5 cents for doing
it. Yes. Don't ask me why. Men needed to bathe more. So it took Luther 4 years to finally admit women. The faculty voted for it in 1931. The alumni were against it. So, and the alumni happened to be very strong on the Board of Education of the Norwegian Church at that time. And the church controlled the college, owned the school, so any change in policy or charter or regulation had to be approved by the college or by the church. And it took 4 years for the church to get around to doing this, for opinions to change. So what Luther did in the meantime, those townspeople who wanted their daughters to go to a local school because they didn't have enough money to send them far away, they started another school right next to Luther, called Decorah Junior College for Women. And it had the same calendar and the same schedule as Luther. Decorah Junior College for Women students were allowed to use the laboratories and the library at Luther, and they shared professors. And this school got accredited, this little junior school for women got accredited in 1 day. Because the people who were in charge of it went to the people who were the crediting agency, and they were all friends, so they just signed and sealed on the dotted line. And the whole struggle for accreditation to meet the standards of colleges in the early 20th century was what killed all of the schools that died. They couldn't get enough money, couldn't get enough good faculty, couldn't get enough equipment and buildings to meet the standards to stay in business as a college. So it really is kind of remarkable that this little college managed to do it. It went out of business about 3 years later when they finally merged with Luther College. And then Luther became co-educational. Muhlenberg in Pennsylvania resisted until 1955. It's been co-ed for less than 30 years. And there the story was exactly the opposite. The church insisted that the school become co-educational. Muhlenberg had gotten very involved after the Second World War when all of the vets returned with professional collegiate football. And they were into big football at Muhlenberg and spending lots of money on their football team. And the church said, this is not appropriate to a church college, and asked them to scale down their athletics. And for about 6 years, there was this pitched fight between the church and the school about whether the school would give in to the church and do that, or whether it would try to be independent, to separate from the church and be a private independent college. The result of the fight finally was that Muhlenberg did give in to the church, and the athletics were scaled down to normal college athletics, and women were admitted to be students. You can imagine the reception those women had the first few years. Mm-hmm. Okay, just a couple of things. The school that probably pisses me off the most. I know, but it really does. It's Roanoke College in Virginia. I mean, their attitude just really blows me away.
Virginia.
They started in the 1840s again as a preacher school. When the Civil War came, because they were in Virginia, war took away all their students, so they admitted women for two semesters, 1860 and 1861. Then the men came back, so they kicked the women out. They didn't admit women again until 1887, so what, 20 some odd years later, and the only reason they admitted them was because the daughters of some of the faculty members needed a school to go to. That was another big impetus in why schools finally went co-ed, was because daughters of professors needed a place to study. So they admitted women to Roanoke beginning in 1887, but they didn't give them any degrees. You could study for 4 years, you could earn first distinction, be valedictorian of your school, but you got no certificate or degree as a result of your study. They continued this until 1913, when they decided that they'd had enough of women, so they kicked them out again. And they finally realized that, as it said in the resolution, that it had been a hardship for these women who had studied not to have degrees. So in 1922, they gave retroactive degrees to everybody who had studied between 1887 and 1913. Okay? Then the Depression came along, and they admitted women again in 1930, but they never took an action saying that they were for co-education at Roanoke. There are women studying there. There's a women's dorm there finally now, but they don't have any record that they have ever actually accepted co-education at Roanoke to this day. They have never declared themselves for co-education. That's why they piss me off. Three times women were admitted, and twice they were kicked out. So
one wonders why any women would want to go there.
Yes, yes, one wonders that a lot. And one has great admiration for those women who were the first students and who went to study in that kind of environment and managed to survive.
At a school like that, is the percentage of women low?
Oh, yeah. It was in those early days. I mean, in the first 10 years of Wittenberg being co-educational, there were three women graduates, Professor Geiger's daughters. That was it until 1884, and then another woman graduated.
Today there'd
be many, many more. Mm-hmm. it's much more 50-50 in most of the colleges. One of the other things which is interesting, and I would never have seen this as a pattern if I hadn't done this paper, was the acceptance of co-education. And that was in the whole question of dormitories. Women were often admitted to schools, but asked to find housing in the towns where the schools were located, or they were day students who were expected to live at home with their families. But in almost every single case that I researched, it took anywhere from 10 to 38 years before the school built a dormitory for women on campus, had facilities for women to live on campus.
And that was really hard, because I wouldn't imagine that the towns that the colleges were in were really super in love with women being students. I mean,
well, some of the towns were the ones that really pushed the schools to admit women students. One town actually said, we won't allow you to establish a school for preachers here unless you also establish a school for women at the same time. Mm-hmm. So it was really the townspeople that pushed for the education.
Why do you think that was, though, Pat, that they weren't interested in housing them? I mean, was that
I don't know whether
the tentativeness of the decision to go co-educational, or?
Pardon me? I just didn't hear.
Oh, I said, was that part of the tentativeness of the decision to go co-educational?
I think so. I think it was the tentativeness about that decision. It was the fact that there were few women students, the fact that there were very few women faculty and staff at these schools until really the 1890s and into the 20th century.
Yeah, Pat, when there were early schools for elementary, when there was a woman teacher, they had all the town or the surrounding just vied to get her to stay 6 weeks, somebody else 6 weeks. Mm-hmm.
That's true. That's true. So, but for higher education, it was very much a different story.
Pacific Lutheran put a door in the middle of a hall, and the men were on one end and the women on the other, on each floor. That was like in the 30s. I don't know what they did before that.
Well, the boys stayed in the dorm and the women lived in town. It was the same pattern at PLU. One of the things that was, I mean, you find some interesting things. Concordia Moorhead, Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota, when they started, they had co-ed floors in their dorms. They had women on one floor and men on another floor. Some 38 years later, when Augustana, Rock Island, finally got around to building a women's dorm, the money was going to come from the Women's Missionary Society. And they were all set to give the money to the school for building the women's dorm until they discovered that it was to be built right adjacent to the men's dorm. And they decided they didn't want this to happen, that this was the two sexes were living too close together. So they told the school that they would not give them the money for the women's dorm unless they moved the dorm to another location. And the architect said the same thing. Build the dorm. And the board of directors looked at the alternate site and said, no, we want it at the original site. That's the place that it makes the most sense. And the missionary society said, no, we won't give you the money to build it there. So the board finally said, okay, we'll move it to the site that you want, by which time the board had said, it's all right, we'll let you build it at the first site. This conversation, if you will, went back and forth for 8 years before they finally got around to getting the dorm actually built for women. And then they did build it adjacent to the men's dorm.
It might sound a little silly, except I've talked to some people in the dorms at my school. I can't believe this. They have three long dorms. And one's guys and gals, and the guys and girls, guys, whatever the orders. And I was just shocked to find out that these guys sit there with their binoculars and stare across into the other dorms, watch the girls undress at night.
Oh boy.
I mean, this is 1984.
Just a couple of other stories, because I think they're kind of fun. one of the points that I make at some length in my paper is the important support that women provided to the schools, even the all-male schools, without which they wouldn't have gotten started. And I think maybe you can guess at what that support was. Of the 9 schools that I looked at, 6 of them started in a preacher's house. And so the preacher's wife became an instant dorm mother to all of these young men who came to live. And one preacher complained bitterly that there were 23 people living in his house. And this went on for a whole year until they got a building built that they could use for dormitory facilities for people. So you have a pretty good idea of what that woman was doing for most of that year. Women did a lot of the traditional kinds of things that women do that are very much taken for granted. They cooked, they cleaned, they were the welcomers for these young men who came, because most of them were 13, 14, 15 years old. They'd come from very far away. Dick Solberg tells the story of his own dad who came to St. Olaf in the 1870s, soon after it opened. And his dad had come in the winter, for the winter quarter, because he'd been at home with harvest during the fall. And he came and it was cold and he was scared, and he knocked on the door of front door of Maine, and Mrs. Moan, who was the president's wife, opened the door and invited him to come in and to have a cup of hot chocolate. And she sat down with him and talked with him and asked how he was. He decided as a result of that cup of hot chocolate to stay at St. Olaf to get his education. But he often told his son that if it hadn't been for Mrs. Moan, he would have turned around and gone back home. Yeah. Just because it was such a terrifying experience to do that. And I think the subtitle for the paper really should be Coffee and Cookies, because it really was the women's hospitality and their generous assistance to students in the ordinary experiences of living that really made the difference for them. You find in the anecdotes stories about the women who started sewing circles, and they would card and spin and weave and knit and sew clothes for the men going to school. They'd make ties and shirts and bedding and long underwear and socks. And so you have these records of this woman sent one pair of long underwear and one pair of socks to Luther College for the students. Mm-hmm. Other women would give food. They'd bring a jar of butter or a turkey dinner so that the dorm students would have something to eat. When Luther College dedicated its first building in 1865, the women of the local congregation served 2,000 people lunch. Every time a building was built or dedicated at a Lutheran school, the women served lunch. That doesn't sound like a very big thing to do until you imagine what it would have been like if there hadn't been any lunches for all those specifications. I think I could go on, but I think I won't.
Pat, did you say when the first women faculty started?
Yeah, the first woman, I think the first woman in the college faculty was at the actual college level, was also at Wittenberg. Alice, I guess Maurer is how you'd say your name, M-O-W-R-E-R, graduated in 1884 and came back to the school to teach 1891, and taught for 54 years at Wittenberg. And do you know that that fact is not even recorded in the institutional history of Wittenberg? I had to piece that together from some other information.
What did she do?
She taught Latin and English. Another woman who graduated just a couple of years after her, Grace Prince, who was the daughter of one of the faculty members at Wittenberg, came back in 1892 as the librarian at Wittenberg and was there for 50 years until 1942. And she merited one line. It's very interesting because, you know, some of the men who were professors at these institutions
Thomas, who also taught for many years, you get their whole careers, where they were born, where they studied, what they taught, what contributions they made to the school. So there's a great need to recover the history.
Have there been any women presidents yet of any of these institutions?
No. There have been no women presidents of Lutheran institutions. I would say that of all the Lutheran colleges, there have probably been no more than 10 women who've been members of boards of regents or boards of trustees. But just generally what I found, just because it may be interesting, with the turn of the century and the expansion of normal schools, they were called, which were schools for training teachers, women became, many more women started going to school. And by about the 1920s and 30s, there were a lot of women teaching in schools. I think the percentage had gone up to 35% and 40%. Second World War came, and there were lots of women in school. When the Second World War ended, and the vets came back to school, women faculty dropped drastically, and women's enrollment dropped drastically. There was a real strong encouragement to women to concentrate on getting married and having children and not going to school. And one of the schools really lamented the fact that during the 1950s there was a 50% dropout rate among women who enrolled in schools. 50% of the women who started didn't finish. And this situation didn't start to turn around until the 1960s with the beginning of the women's movement. And just gradually now in the 60s and 70s and 80s you start having more women in schools and more women faculty.
When did Lutheran denominations first start ordaining?
1970. Yeah, 13 years ago. That's what I say, they're several years behind other denominations.
Head of the Catholics.
Head of the Catholics, right. Yeah. Head of the Catholics.
The Catholics had about 300 AD.
Would you like to know that when Alice Maurer and Grace Prince started teaching, the salary for a full professor was $1,800? So you can imagine what a librarian got and an instructor.
What year was that?
1910.
And the sad thing is that professor did not know
there was a remarkable study done in 1929 for the United Lutheran Church, which just examined every statistic about all the ULCA schools. And they really documented both the lack of women in schools, their lower salaries, their lower educational qualifications, no programs for them to go off and get professional training. This was the reason why Grace College was proposed to be a Lutheran institution for women, to train women not only in higher education, baccalaureate degree, and on into the master's degree. But unfortunately, that college came to a dream stage in 1929, and the Depression just killed it. No possibility they would be able to go on.
But you said there was one woman?
Yes, one woman's college. Well, Grace lasted for, what did I say, 5 years? 10 years? Born in a fight, died in a fire.
When was that?
Elizabeth College. Sorry, Elizabeth College in Virginia. Marion College was a little junior college that started in Virginia and was a real stubborn little institution. It wanted to do its thing its own way, and it fought with the church. Lost.
Now, did that have like women professors?
Yeah, all the women at Marion all the faculty were women. But their standards were so low, the school was so
was very modest in the clientele that it attracted. The women, it couldn't meet the standards for accreditation even of a junior college in Virginia. And that was what finally killed it, was the state system of community colleges came in the mid-1960s, and it just couldn't compete. But there was one woman who was associated with that college who was born the year the college opened, 1873. She was the daughter of the president who died the year the college closed, 1967. She'd been the business manager, refused to be acting president, and was dean of students for 45 years.
She refused to be president?
Mm-hmm. Refused to be acting president. So there are some real stories. If you could get behind just those dates and find out something about who those people were.
What was the life?
I just wondered if there was any way to, or if anybody had contacted any of the old former students and things for their anecdotes about what they remember.
Not in this project, because it has a different focus. But one of the things that I really would like to recommend in writing the paper is that schools start to do that. Because in the archives of the schools, there's no information about people. You know, there are board minutes and records of buildings being dedicated and all that kind of stuff. But there are no diaries and letters and conversations and interviews and,
Pat, what are those three areas that you see for further study?
What would be the three that I think would be most important? I'd like to see the study of women as students, because one of the tantalizing things that just flits through some of the work is that Phi Beta Kappa chapters and honor systems didn't come to colleges until after they became co-ed, generally. And it would really be interesting to me to know what was the influence of students, of women students and men students together on student government policies, whether that was just related to the times or whether there was really something there about women that made the development of those things more likely. I'd like to know much more about women faculty, what their role and influence was, how they helped shape the institution. And there's just no information there at all. And then I'd like to see some more work done about the foremothers, the women who were wives of faculty, who were wives of presidents, who were staff members in very lowly positions, their contribution. Because there's just enough information to say that those people were really critical to a school. But we don't know enough about them. The other thing which would be interesting is to study women and their financial contributions. Because it's amazing to see how much money women gave higher education in the Lutheran Church as women, either as single women or as widows. And they supported all male schools as well as co-ed schools. And there's just no acknowledgement of that in these histories at all. I mean, it's mentioned, but you just go right by it. A woman gave $25,000 to endow a theological chair at Wittenberg. And it merits one line, and I don't even think the chair was named after her. I mean, this was $25,000 in the 1880s. Can you imagine how much money that was? You know, and when a man gave $40,000, they named the whole bloody school after him.
Which one is that?
Yama, Divinity School, which now has merged with Trinity Seminary, merged to become part of Trinity Seminary in Columbus. there's one very touching story about women's financial contributions. I'll end with this. A woman in 1853 was a child when her mother died, and then president of Luther College, or the man who became the president of Luther College, Lars Larsen, came and had her funeral, her mother's funeral. And she heard them talking about the school. Maybe this was in 1863. I'm 10 years off on my days. 1863. She heard them talking about the school. And she was so moved by that that when she got her first teaching job at the age of 14 and got her paycheck, her first paycheck was $16 for a month's teaching in this elementary school, she sent $2 to Luther College. And she sent $2 from every paycheck she ever made for as long as she lived to that school. So that's, and there are a lot of those kinds of stories. Women really making sacrificial commitments in order for their sons and daughters or others' sons and daughters to be able to go to school. Thank you. You've really been a very attentive group, and I've enjoyed your questions. Thanks for sharing this humongous project.